Okay. All right. Looks like we got a pretty good crowd here. Thank you for coming to this morning's session. My name is Chris Hallam. I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. So what that means is any of the security technologies that are inside the Windows Client Operating Systems itself or shared in server, those are technologies that fall into under my domain. So that includes things like BitLocker, now with Windows 8 biometrics, AppLocker, any of those things that keep the system secure. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about what's new in Windows Blue or 8.1 security. And there's a ton of new security content within this one-year release. So I think you're going to be impressed at the end of the session with the volume of new capabilities that we've delivered into the operating system. So as we go through the agenda, we're going to start with a quick discussion on what we achieved in Windows 8. A lot of you are still looking at Windows 8 maybe for the first time or still evaluating it. So I'm going to make sure that it's very, very clear the total value from a security perspective we're able to deliver in that release because it's substantial. We have some interesting data now coming back from the telemetry data that we collect from PCs that show how good the results are, particularly in malware resistance. So you're going to see some impressive improvement numbers there that prove how well we did. We'll talk about a new threat landscape. Things are very, very different when it comes to security, at least in our view, versus where we were at maybe 5 years ago. There's some new threats, and for that reason, there are new investments in Windows 8.1 to address these new incoming types of issues that we anticipate in the future. So with that, let's dig in. With Windows 8, our goal at the very, very beginning of the release was to deliver the most substantial set of security capabilities that we delivered in a single release ever in Windows. So we set this goal very purposely. We staffed, from a human resource perspective, the project so we could deliver that volume of capability, and we fully funded it. So it's really no surprise that we were able to deliver, basically three generations of OS security improvements in a single release, because that's the goal that we set out to do. And it was very important that we set that objective, because I think when it came to malware on the Windows platform, while Windows 7 was pretty good at malware resistance, there were some things that we had to do much, much, much better. Malware resistance was the biggest feature area of the release from a security perspective. I like to call it the hero, because I think that's where we made the largest set of improvements, and I'll show you that in a few minutes, how good those improvements are. But there are a couple things within malware resistance that we did feature-wise that are worth noting. The first area is we completely secured the entire boot process. In Windows 7 and previous operating system, the boot process was susceptible to tampering. And the reason why was because we didn't have anything in Windows that hardened the boot process, and we didn't have anything in hardware to prevent tampering at a low level. So if you're familiar with low-level boot kits, you'll know that they tamper with the master boot record and they redirect the boot to the malware, and then malware starts Windows. And when that happens, the malware is running in the background, and Windows would never see that type of infection because, of course, the malware has started before it. So we needed to eradicate that type of infection vector. And with Windows 8, we were able to do that with a new technology that we call UEFI, Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. Is a hardware component that replaces BIOS. And what we get with that is we get a secure startup of the operating system. That could be Windows. That could be iOS. It could be anything on a PC type of device. But, of course, in our case, we have a secure startup of the Windows OS loader. You can't have something starting before it from a boot perspective. And I'll explain a little bit about that later. The next thing we did is we completely secured our core in a way that was familiar to many of you, but we did it to a much larger degree. There are two technologies that are important in warding off vulnerability exploits. Those are ALSR and DEP. We had these technologies in Windows 7 and even Vista, but we didn't really use them extensively in the OS. They were only targeted at a few specific areas. In Windows 8, we've increased the capability of these features, and we've increased their use across all of the Windows core. And so in a minute, I'll show you some dramatic impact results from those features. There are a number of other things that we could mention. We have sandboxed apps with new modern apps, and there's a number of other features. But in the end, malware resistance really was our most impressive improvement area in the release. When it comes to protecting sensitive data, our goal was to make sure that all of you are deploying an encryption solution, hopefully BitLocker, to your PC. Encryption is difficult to provision. It takes a long time to encrypt a large hard drive or even a small one. And so we work really hard to make sure that BitLocker could be provisioned faster than really anything else out there in the marketplace. And so for this reason, now we're seeing customers deploying encryption not just to their laptops, their mobile devices. We're seeing it go into their data centers, on their servers, and also on their desktops. And so because it's so easy, why wouldn't you deliver this type of encryption capability? And actually, something that a lot of people have not thought about, a lot of people think that encryption, like BitLocker, is only useful in protecting corporate data. You actually need encryption to protect the operating system itself. Because if somebody can get physical access to your PC, they can tamper with the binaries on that PC. It's critical that you protect everything on the box, not just your corporate data, but also the operating system itself. Think about that new scenario as a reason to push that across your organization. We're almost wrapped up here on 8, but one last thing to mention is modern access control is another investment area that we had in Windows 8, and there were really two things we did there. Two-factor authentication, as you know, is something that's very difficult to use because it's expensive and challenging and whatnot. With Windows 8, we're able to deliver a virtual smart card technology that leverages your trusted platform module. So rather than having a smart card, you know, in your hand that you have to plug in, now the PC itself becomes a smart card. And so now you can electronically provision a smart card device and now get two-factor authentication without a reader, without a card, and without the supportability headaches that you're used to with a typical true two-factor authentication solution. So these are virtual smart cards are a great solution. I think that there's still scenarios where you want a physical card. We'll talk about that a little bit, but this virtual option allows you to maybe use two-factor more broadly in your organizations. And so with that, I think I'll move into the newer content because I want to make sure that we hit that pretty hard. But that gives you an idea of where we're at. One last thing that I should mention is there's a gentleman from the United States. He worked recently for Covetry, which is a security research firm. His name's Chris Valasek. Maybe you know him. He speaks at Black Hat, very notable security researcher. He agreed with what we did, which was we decided to go deliver the largest set of security capabilities in one OS release. He was quoted at Black Hat saying that in Windows 8, we delivered the same quantity of security improvements as we did between XP, XP, SP2, Vista, and 7 all in a single release. That's what he said. He said another thing was interesting, too. He's a person whose life is about learning how to hack on systems. That's his job. He said he would never want to be tasked with a job of having to hack on Windows 8. Not that it's not possible, because we know that it will be possible and somebody will breach our systems eventually, but he said that it's so much more difficult than it was before that he would really need a lot of people to help him to get that. So we're very proud of our improvements here, but there's much more to do. Let's talk about one thing here about which is related to how successful our malware resistance capabilities are. This chart is from April's Security Intelligence Report, which comes from the Trustworthy Computing Group, which, of course, is a Microsoft group. We collect telemetry data from all of our PCs. The customers who opt into this program can send us information. And so we're able to observe all sorts of interesting things going on PCs, like malware infections. This chart shows two different ways of looking at things. It showed PCs that were not protected with an anti-malware solution. So let's say maybe Defender was disabled, or maybe McAfee or Symantec, maybe the trial edition on that PC expired. So the PC is in an unprotected state, but maybe still has an anti-malware solution, but it's not doing anything. And then, of course, we also looked at PCs that were protected with malware. In the case of Windows 8, for every 1,000 PCs, based on the machines that we looked at, which were in the millions, 2.7 PCs had some sort of malware infection that was detected on it. When we go to 7 SP1, it basically triples. It goes to 8.8 for 1,000. And then I'm going to ignore Vista, but if we go to XP, it's 15.6 PCs for every 1,000 had an infection. So that's with no anti-malware solution running. That's just a very unprotected PC. It's just whatever the native Windows defenses are there. But let's take a look and see what happens when you add an anti-malware solution. For every 1,000.2 on Windows 8, and if we look at 7, 1.2, 6 times more infections on 7 than on 8. And if we go to XP, SP3, 21 times more. So if you're running XP and you want to know is there value in going to a modern OS, here's your proof point. 21 times more likely to be infected with malware than 8. So we're very proud of the improvements here, and I think it speaks to things like Secure Boot from UEFI, Trusted Boot, ALSR and DEP, App Containers. All these things contributed towards a much better malware capability on the new OS. So that's really great. So let's take a look at what's happening next. So when we went through the Windows 8 product cycle, Windows 8, in our view, actually was the culmination. So that was the culmination of 10 years worth of ideas. So when we got hit with Slammer and Code Red and all these terrible things that happened in the Windows XP timeframe, where we became aware that Windows is not secure, right? When we learned that in the XP timeframe, we looked at the threats, we looked at the operating system, we analyzed it very carefully, and we set a vision that would take us a decade to achieve. We would have loved to be able to do it sooner, but some of the things weren't in our control, such as hardware and number factors. But Windows 8 really represents, we think, that culmination. We finally achieved the goal that we set out when we learned about Code Red and Slammer, right? So that's 10 years of investment. During this period, especially during the Windows 8 process, and starting in Windows 7, we started to see a trend towards a new type of attack. We're all familiar with malware. Malware has not gone away. But we're seeing people rush over towards identity theft. It's become so difficult, even on 7, to attack the system with, you know, exploits of vulnerabilities. It now requires teams of people to figure this out. It's generally not an individual who can do this, although there are some bright individuals who can. But we're seeing that it's much easier to trick somebody into giving them your identity. Or if they hack LinkedIn or somebody, they can get your password and identity from that. And so we're seeing that malware is of interest, but we're seeing that maybe more nation states are messing around with malware. And now people are just going after your identity directly. And so it's time to reassess the threat. And because they're stealing your identity, it's also very easy to get into your network because they can log in as you. And so our view is that there are really two types of enterprises now. There are those who've been hacked. Microsoft's been hacked. Yahoo's been hacked. Apple, Google, every top-of-the-line company, right, who has literally an unlimited security budget to protect its network has been hacked, right? These are people who have the best in the industry, difficult to protect themselves against these tenacious attackers. So there's those who realize they've been hacked and they've talked about it, like us. And then we believe there are those who just don't realize they've been hacked. It's a fairly dramatic statement. Now, I'm not saying here that everybody has been hacked. But if you look at the data out there, Verizon has a report called the Data Breach Report. They do it, I think it's once a year or twice a year. They showed that over 40% of small businesses have had a network intrusion. And then it took over 3 to 6 months for people to detect that intrusion. And what's really interesting about that report is the people who gave them that data were people who were willing or aware of the intrusions. So what about the people who just didn't know that they've been hacked, right? So the number is 40% based on a survey, but probably there's a lot of people who just don't realize that they've been breached. And so our view is that it's very likely that you've been hacked. And so we have to go into that mentality as we move forward in the world of security. And so there's all these familiar threats that we've been talking about for 10 years. New threat, new mitigation. New threat mitigation, just another hamster wheel, a cat and mouse game with the attackers. And now there's these modern threats that are very different that I kind of mentioned a bit ago. There's different threats. It's really going about after your identities. And so we need protections for those more than ever. So let's compare and contrast the familiar threats versus the modern, and then we're going to get into the new features of 8.1. We're all familiar with script kiddies in cybercrime, but now we're dealing with new threats, which is espionage, cyber warfare, cyber sabotage. These are very impactful types of attacks. It's no longer defacing your website and notoriety gaining. It's about stealing your data and selling that in a black market that really exists right now. There's these cyber criminals that you're familiar with, but now they're state-sponsored actors, right? Not always, or very, very sophisticated crime rings, right? That are well-funded, that have staff, that have a check that they receive every week, right? These are full-time employees working on this, and they have unlimited funding in many cases. We're familiar with software solutions that we've delivered in Windows to deal with every new threat. But now, if you don't have hardware to protect you, you're going to be one of those people who gets hacked because you cannot have a secure operating system in today's threat landscape unless you have new modern hardware, things like UEFI, Trusted Platform Module, etc. We're familiar with securing our perimeter. Let's keep the bad guys outside of our network. But now you have to assume you've been breached, and you have to protect at every single level within. the perimeter, the PC, the resources on the PC, the identities, everything has to be protected. And you have to assume that you've been breached. That's a different mentality than many of us have had. I think if you're working in a military and defense, you assume that. But I don't think other businesses outside that area have achieved that mentality yet. We're familiar with Fortune attacks on Fortune 500. But the Verizon report showed that if you're a small business who doesn't think that they have anything of interest to steal, you're totally wrong. If you have credit cards, if you've ever swiped a credit card, you have something of interest. If you have information on a patient in their health records, you have something of interest, and people will be going after that information. So a small business, somebody working in the supply chain of a large company, if you look at Lockheed Martin, very famous military contractor, they deal with hundreds and hundreds of companies in their supply chain. If you're building nuts and bolts for the F-35, you will be attacked because they want to get to those employees and they want to get to that company, and they think if they can get to the company, they maybe can get to Lockheed. So anybody in the supply chain, everybody's at risk. And so the old is that you hope you don't hack, but you probably will be. And so it's really about mitigation. Here's a couple quotes, and then we will get into the meat. This is from F-Secure, who many of you are familiar with. This is in response to Flame. They basically said that the security products that you're using today are not good enough. You are up against the digital equivalent of SEAL Team 6. So if you're all familiar with Osama bin Laden's story, and you know who SEAL Team 6 is, that's the hacker who's going after your network. Right? This is a different, this is an elite shock trooper. Here's from the Verizon report. If you think you're too small, you're wrong. Right? 40% of businesses, small businesses, have been attacked. That came out earlier this year. And then here's a Lockheed Martin statement that talks about their supply chain. They're spending more time dealing with attacks on their supply chain, their partners, their contractors, their employees, their vendors, than they are on themselves. Think about that for a minute, right? There are half their IT budget is dedicated towards protecting people that they work with that are not part of their company. And of course, you're familiar. This data came out a couple weeks ago when we learned that the F-35 missile defense and other systems had been breached. And so those secrets are no longer secure. So moving forward, there are going to be two types of organizations. There's going to be those who adapt to this modern threat and this reality that we've just talked about, and then there are going to be those who don't. And you do not want to be that person. So let's talk about Windows 8.1 and the features that we're going to deliver to you this year to help you get there. So we have a very thick layer of new security capability that we're able to deliver in this one-year product cycle. And so we're very excited to deliver it. The key things that we're going to talk about, because there's a lot of capability here, is biometrics is going to be the new way of signing in. I'll get to more detail in a minute. Adding trustworthiness to public key infrastructure that you're using in your organization and also on the internet is critical. I mentioned earlier that your identities are under attack. We need to fix PKI to the extent that we can in the 1 year that we have to make that system more secure. We need to be able to detect low-level root boot infections that are similar to Flame. We have a feature called Provable PC Health, which we'll talk about, that will deal with the Flame of the future if we ever see one. And then we need to make sure that encryption is delivered to all PCs. And so those are the three investment areas for this release, similar to what we had before. So let's talk about the hardware. Trusted Platform Module, actually let me roll back. UEFI hardware, which gives us the secure startup of the operating system, that's in every new device. Every Windows 8 certified device has secure boot, which is critical in today's age. What every PC does not have is TPM. TPM is not a certification requirement yet, but there's some great news about TPM. First of all, with Windows 8.1, Windows 8, we were able to create firmware TPM. It no longer required on a discrete component. So we could use firmware-based TPM, and we could put that in ARM's Trust Zone, which is a security component on the SOC, or we could put it in Intel's Platform Trust Technology, which is similar security component, so we could put firmware in there. So that means the cost of TPM is zero, right? So this is good. And because of that, we're starting to see TPM is moving into consumer devices. With Intel's Haswell processor, which was released earlier this year, the likelihood that Platform Trust Technology will be in consumer PCs will increase dramatically. You're going to see TPM showing up into those devices this year and into next. And then in 2015, every single Windows PC must have TPM. So we barely have a year left of a TPM optional world. And that just tells you how important it is for our story. And for those of you who are not familiar with TPM, TPM is a crypto processor that allows us to secure secrets and bind them to the physical device. So if you're worried about Mimikatz exporting your identity and your certificates, TPM protects us from that. You can't export that type of secret off of device. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So let's talk about modern access control. I mentioned that malware resistance in Windows 8 was the hero. That's the biggest improvement, the biggest, most dramatic results. In Windows 8.1, modernized access control is the big hero. That's where the biggest investment is. And biometrics is probably one of the first areas that we're investing in. We've had biometrics in the system for a long time. We've had it in XP, Vista, Windows 7. It's always been there, but it's never been used. And the reason why is this. Two things. One, you needed to go to third parties to get the software you needed to actually complete the scenario. So we had a framework, but we didn't have the UI. You needed to go to third parties to get that. Also, the components, the readers themselves, which were fingerprint-based generally, the swipe reader that you used was difficult to use, unreliable. And we now have a new modern age of devices, which we'll show you here in a minute. So with Windows 8.1, we're going in all in on fingerprint-based biometrics. There are many other types. There's facial recognition, there's palm recognition, iris. All these other options are still going to be usable on 8.1, but we're optimizing for the fingerprint biometrics experience. One thing that's important, fingerprints and biometrics in general scare people. They're worried about centralized storage of biometric identities. Your biometric identity never leaves the Windows device. So it's private data, it's yours, it does not move into the cloud, it cannot be exported, etc. So you can use biometrics without the fear of the privacy concerns because it's only on your device. So for fingerprint technologies, there's many different options. There's optical, thermal, ultrasound, capacitive, etc. And many of you who've looked into this so far go, oh, well, they can be spoofed. I can spoof those fingerprint readers. Those are not good enough. That's not true anymore, and I'll show you in a moment. This is a case from Brazil. This image here is a series of silicone fingers that had fingerprints on them. There was a series of doctors that worked at a hospital. In order to check into work and start getting paid, you used a biometric fingerprint image to sign in, and then you got paid, and then you left and you signed out. Well, these five doctors decided that they would rather go to the beach. And so three doctors would show up on shift, and they would sign the other two friends in, and the other two would go to watch football or go to the bar or maybe sleep in all day. I don't know what they did, but they were getting paid while they were at home doing something. Here's another image of that. So it's a pretty interesting silicone image, very lifelike, but it was not full of life. It was quite dead. And so the characteristics of a modern reader are a reader that are touch-based. So it's not the swipe-based that's difficult. It's touch. I just touch to get in. And it can tell the difference between a dead finger. This is a fingerprint from a morgue. So this is a deceased person. This is what somebody looks like when they're alive with a modern reader that has a feature called liveness detection. So a good reader, a modern reader, and actually even the swipe readers have liveness detection. They can tell the difference. An optical reader, like the one they had in Brazil, is inferior. It's a scanner. It's not going to work from a security standpoint. So here's an image of a reader. What we're looking at in the middle there is a silicone chip that has the ability to detect a live finger versus one that's not. And those are going to be showing up to PCs quite soon. And I'll show you a demo here in a minute. So what else have we done? In addition to providing better components from a sensor standpoint, well, what else are we going to do? We're going to have all of the UI that you need is in the box, as I mentioned earlier. So the ability to enroll your fingers, you don't need to go to Lenovo to download their software to use your Lenovo biometric reader. It's now in the box. That biometric enrollment UI works on any of the supported sensors that are out there. So anything that's in production today, Windows can support that, and of course these new ones down the road as well. So you'll be able to sign into all experience in Windows, the login, authenticating to my VPN, anywhere that asks for domain credentials, I can use my biometric identity, so everywhere pretty much. And I can also use my biometric identity to confirm a purchase. So when I go to the Windows Store and I make a purchase, I can confirm the purchase with my biometric identity rather than using my password. And what we know is anytime the password gets in a way, what do? We type in our username, our password, and then we check the box saying, never ever ask me that again, because that's too much hassle. With biometrics, It's very simple. I get a confirmation window, I touch to sign in or confirm, and I can make a purchase without any friction. So this is pretty cool. The other thing we can do is we can use our biometric identity not only for authentication and consent to purchases, but also verification that the person sitting in front of the PC is still the person who signed in. What we know is when we sign into our PC and we walk away, people in this audience lock their PC when they leave, right? Because we're security people, but most people do not. And so that device is vulnerable for a short period of time. If you have sensitive information and sensitive apps, you can protect those apps with biometric confirmation, and I'll show you that here in a minute. So pretty cool there. So I can protect an app, and I can also protect app data as well. I want to be really clear about the app data piece. There was a report in Verge magazine a couple weeks ago where they reported that you could go into File Explorer and you could select all of your photographs or your files, select all, and then lock them with your biometric identity and encrypt it. They misunderstood what we were doing, that we did not do that, although that is an interesting feature of the future. What we did do is we have an API that applications can call that can protect the data that they generate. So in the United States, we have an application called TurboTax. Once a year we pay our taxes. That file could be protected by that application with my biometric identity so that it could be encrypted and not exported and used by somebody else. So it's only the app data that it generates that can be protected with this capability. But in the future, we think that Verge's idea would be very interesting. So maybe we would get there one day. All right, so let's show some demos. All right, so we go to... Okay. So we have two readers. The one on your left is from Fingerprint Cards of Sweden. This is a touch-based sensor. And as you can tell if anybody has a Lenovo in the office, they have a very thin swipe-based reader that you raise your finger across. With this, I just touch and I'm in. Very simple. It takes less than a second for it to basically identify who you are and then sign you in or authenticate or provide consent, etc. So this is super fast, super reliable. It's no longer three attempts to get my swipe reader to work. It works every single time right away. What we have on the left here is another company. This one's from Validity, another biometrics company in the United States. They have a different implementation but the same idea. It's a touch-based sensor. Looks different. Same type of experience. Touch, and it confirms my identity. So let me show you how these devices work really quick. Okay. All right, so we have our lock screen. This is for my PC, and of course, in honor of the Tour de France, I've picked a famous Canadian. Are there any Canadians in the audience? Probably not. They went to Tech Ed North America. But at any rate, this is my lock screen, and when I want to sign in, I just put my finger on the surface, and I'm in. I didn't have to type in my password once or twice and fumble around. It took me less than a second to get in. And what's really interesting here, I didn't even have to select a profile. Windows automatically figures out who I am based on my biometric identity and logs me into that profile. So this is a great time saver. No, flip the lock screen, select a profile, fumble around with a password to get in. I can sign in a second, whereas I think it usually takes about 10 seconds or more and maybe some frustration to sign in with today's implementation with passwords, et cetera. So this is really a nice advancement. Another thing we can do with biometrics, so that gives you an idea of sign in. I could use this biometric identity to log into a VPN. I'm not going to show you that because you know what it would look like. It's going to ask for my fingerprint and I would be able to go in. But let me show you two other experiences. There's an application here. Actually, let me show you the store first. So that's an authentication scenario. Let me show you a consent scenario. So I'm going to consent to a purchase by going to the Windows Store. I'm going to find a game that's interesting. I really like Angry Birds, just like all of you. So when I go to the store or Xbox Music, or if I'm in an application that you build that has in-app purchase capability, I can hook into biometric framework here. And so when I hit buy and confirm, I should be confirming with my biometric identity instead of my password. So I have a little bug here, apparently. And probably because I was switching my USB, it probably didn't know. It should be asking for my biometric identity here. So I apologize that did not work as anticipated. But you can imagine what that experience would look like, obviously. I'll show you another example. So sorry about that. All right, let me go to another one. So I can provide consent, authentication, but what about verification that this is really me in front of the PC? Let's go to an application called Rounds. Some of you have seen this before. This is just a demo application that we use. It's for physicians and doctors. It's fictional application. But the idea here is that when I go use an application like this, if I'm a physician, I'm going to get access to very, very confidential information about my patients. And so what we had in Windows 8 is they hit physician, they had to type a username and password to get in, and that created a lot of friction. What we've done is we've added the APIs to support using biometrics. So now when I select physician, it now asks for my fingerprint identity. And I can provide a custom message. Here it says, please provide consent to access these patient records. And I can touch to get in. And so now I have access to all this rich information about the patients that are under my care. And I can then get more information about them, right? So the thing that's cool, too, here is unlike my username and password, which may have been compromised, with my biometric identity, I actually know that it was really that user. Right, so I know it's not only the user, but now I can audit that, and I can prove it was really the user that got in there. It wasn't somebody who stole the user's name and password because somebody wrote it down on paper. I really know who it is. And so from an audit perspective, from a compliance perspective, this is a gold mine. This is great for any sort of things that would need to be looked up, either through regulatory reasons or for internal audits, et cetera. I really know who did this. And so biometrics is much more than just authentication. It's about consent. Authentication is also verification. All right, so let's go back to our presentation. And let's go to a new area. So virtual smart cards. Virtual smart cards, as I mentioned earlier, this is great. Right? This is a great feature. It's going to allow you to add two-factor authentication very easily across all of your organization. How many of you, just with a raise of hands, are using... Actually, how many people are not using two-factor authentication in your organizations holistically across your organization, meaning everything is protected with two-factor? There's more. Got to be more hands. Okay, so there's a lot of people like this who don't want to admit it. But anyway, the point is maybe 80%, based on a quick check, maybe it was above 50, but somewhere between 50 and 80 are not using it. And the reason why is it's too expensive. If in the case of a smart card, $50 per PC, basically. That means I need to have a reader, I need a card, and I need to manage it, usually about $50. Could be a lot more, might be less. If I forget my smart card at home and I can't do my job, then how much do you get paid per hour? And now it's costing a lot more. So a lot of people don't deploy because of these issues. With virtual smart cards, I can electronically provision a smart card, which is basically a certificate. I can then use Windows to render it or model it as a virtual smart card reader and a virtual smart card itself. And now I have two-factor authentication. And then this PC that I have here is my smart card. It travels with me at all times. So this gives me a pretty powerful thing. But to be very clear, because we have security people in the audience, this does not really give me two-factor sign-in, because the device is always equipped with the smart card reader, right? It's two-factor when you go from this PC across the network to a resource. So be careful about that. If you need local two-factor authentication for local sign-on, virtual smart card's not the good solution. It's only good when you go out to the network and need to authenticate with something out there. But this allows you to deliver this maybe holistically across your organization in a cheap way and raise your overall security level. So anyway, the thing that's interesting about 8.1 is in 8.0, you had to be domain joined to get a smart card unless you went through all sorts of complexity to deliver it to a non-domain joined device. We have now an API that makes it very easy to provision a virtual smart card to any device, managed or unmanaged, meaning non-domain joined. So now I would imagine that when we have TPM out there in a few years, my hope is that a bank would provision a virtual smart card to your PC and you would use that to access your account. So we think that that is now possible because we have all the pieces in place. The only thing we need now is consumers to buy devices with TPM, and that's starting to happen now. I'm going to go ahead and skip this demo here because it's really not impressive. I enroll in a smart card and it grabs one. So we'll move on because I want to show you some other things instead. So, trustworthy identities and devices. So I mentioned earlier that PKI is of course central to our security story. This is used on the internet, it's used on your internal networks, etc. And PKI is of course probably the weak link that we have right now. It's well protected, but we have some famous cases where PKI has failed us. And I have a list of them. For those of you who are familiar with DigiNotar, they used to be a certificate authority. They don't exist anymore. And why was that? They had been tricked into delivering Google and Yahoo's and a number of others' private keys to a user who called in and pretended that they were a person from one of those companies. So they were able to get authentic, real certificates from a certificate authority through deception. Another case is Stuxnet. So Stuxnet is similar to DigiNotar, but a different attack. Rather than tricking somebody, they walked into the central authority and they stole directly from the company. In that case, I think it was Realtek and a couple others. So they went on premise and they were able to get the certificates and they were able to walk away with them. So they used that technique. In the case of Flame had a hacked cert. So they were able to use a certificate that was using MD5 and they were able to use a collision attack to recreate that certificate. So that certificate looked real to everybody in the world. And that was part of the Flame. There's multiple certificate issues with Flame. It's a very complex piece of malware, but that was one of the attack vectors they had, was to duplicate a certificate. That's not supposed to be possible, but because that certificate was using MD5, which is an old algorithm, they were able to pull it off. The last one here is very different in that this is where we have certificates that have been provisioned to a PC that are not supposed to be exportable. So as you know, we have a flag that says do not export, right? Mimikatz can defeat that. So if you have a user who has physical access to the PC, has the ability to log on as an administrator, they can use Mimikatz and they can export your certificates even though they're marked non-exportable. That's not supposed to be possible, but it is. And so these are four attack vectors that we're going to deal with in 8.1. So what are the assumptions that allowed these things to work? Well, the assumption is that with PKI is that your certificates have never been breached. Right? When I receive a certificate that says it's yours, I trust that it's not coming from somebody else. Right? It's all based on this really bad assumption that everything is secure. And I just showed you, there's four cases where we know that they maybe haven't been secure. So our goal for 8.1 is to increase the trustworthiness of the PKI system to drive what we're calling crypto hygiene. So make sure on the internet that these certificates that are flying around at light speed, that they are trustworthy, right? And then we want to make sure that when you have a certificate that's provisioned to your device, that it can't be stolen. So let's talk about how. So when it comes to securing private certificates, meaning corporate identities, the identity of your device, the identity of you, we're going to protect those in a couple ways. With Windows 8, we delivered a feature called TPM KSP. So if you're familiar with the key storage provider, that's where the certificate goes and it gets protected, right? On Windows 7, that's a software-only feature. And so Mimikatz can trick that system and export your certificates. In Windows 8.0, TPM KSP takes that certificate and binds it to the PC. So that certificate, while technically it could be exported, it could only be exported in an encrypted state, so it's useless once it leaves a device. It's only usable when it's on the PC that was provisioned to, because it requires the TPM to decrypt it before it can be used. So when you use TPM to protect your certificates, these certificates never leave the PC. Not technically true, but they never leave them in a way where they're usable. So TPM KSP 8.0 feature. We take it to the next level in 8.1 by adding a feature called key attestation. So let's imagine this scenario where I have two PCs. I provision my certificates to two of them. One has TPM and protects it with KSP. The other one does not have TPM KSP. So that one is susceptible to the Mimikatz attack. So let's say somebody attacks that PC and steals my identity, and I have the third PC, the malicious user's PC, that now has my identity. When that user connects to a corporate resource, it's going to trust it. It's going to say, yeah, I know that certificate. That's you. Go ahead and have access. With TPM key attestation, what's going to happen is you can set access control policy on your VPN or whatever that says, I only trust the certificate if you can prove to me that certificate was provisioned to you securely and persisted and secured by the TPM. So only machine A would work because it's been securely provisioned, it has TPM KSP, it's been protected, and now it's connecting. Machine 2 and 3 that don't have TPM They would use their certs, and they would be denied access because they don't have a secure certificate. It may be secure. It may be actually your PC, but you can set up your access control policy to say, we don't trust TPM machines that do not have TPM. So this is a pretty cool thing, and this is to address the Mimikatz threat. And we think that this is a type of attack that we're going to see at scale in the future. So we believe we're getting a little bit ahead of the game before this becomes a huge widespread problem. So it's a little bit forward-looking, but very powerful. So your certificates are now secure when they get delivered to the box, and they can be proven to be secure as they're used. So let's talk about how we're going to improve PKI in the public space. So when I go to Microsoft.com or Google or Yahoo, I'm going to get their public certificate, and I'm going to use it. What we saw in the case of DigiNotar, where somebody was issued, you know, authentic certificates. Well, what they did in the DigiNotar case is they got the certificates and they set up servers in another country, and they were able to redirect traffic using DNS poisoning, and they were able to use Google's certificate and impersonate Google and Yahoo in this case. The users, of course, would never know this, and so they were duped into a number of things. They ended up downloading malware. They had their identity stolen. A number of different things happened because of this. And so what we can do with our new feature in Windows 8.1, which is a cloud-based service, is we're going to crawl the internet. For the top 1 million websites, we're going to collect those certificates, and we're going to put them in a database, and we're going to analyze them. And then later down the road, when we find another website that has Google's certificate, or Yahoo's or Microsoft's, we're going to compare that versus the list of certificates, and we're going to look at it to find out, well, was it issued for the same servers as yesterday? Or is this a new server in Dagestan that got set up with an authentic certificate? So we'll be able to identify when certificates start to appear in strange places that they've never been seen before, and then we would be able to investigate. It may be perfectly normal. Yes, maybe Yahoo sets up some new servers, or Microsoft sets up a new data center, and so maybe it makes sense. But we'll be able to investigate. Today, we only find out after it's too late. Tomorrow, literally the next day this happens, we'll be able to investigate. And if we find out that that's an illegitimate server, an illegitimate use of that certificate, we can then revoke those certificates. Now, Microsoft wouldn't revoke it. We would provide information to the certificate authorities, and then they would pursue their certificate revocation process. So, and before doing that, they would contact Microsoft or Google, etc. But this cloud-based service is going to be very powerful in making sure that the certificates being used on the internet are coming from the right sources. We can also, when we receive a certificate, we can look deep inside it. On the surface, the flame virus looked like it was an authentic using an authentic signature. But when we look closely at it, we actually can detect that it was fraudulently created. So we're going to be able to look at these certificates very closely, and we're going to be able to detect if somebody cracks, you know, SHA, right, we'll be able to maybe identify that as well. So maybe Flame V2 could be detected more quickly because this certificate, maybe it looks fine on the surface, but within it, we can see that it's actually fraudulently created. So these two things, the protection using the TPM KSP for the private certs and the public certs on the internet, the things we're doing with this cloud service are, I think, pretty interesting. This is going to benefit Microsoft users, Apple users, Google users, anybody who's using certificates. This is not a Windows 8.1 feature in some respects. It's just delivered in that time frame. It's to clean up the public key infrastructure on the internet. So everybody in the world is going to benefit from this. But there's things I think we could do in the future to maybe make it better for Windows clients. But we'll hopefully get there later down the road. But in the meantime, everybody is going to enjoy this feature. So let's talk about protecting sensitive data. So in Windows 8, we delivered a feature called device encryption. Device encryption was delivered on Windows RT and Windows Phone 8. Device encryption is basically full disk encryption, and it's automatically provisioned. So a lot like our mobile phones that are already encrypted when we receive them, now we have Windows devices that are automatically encrypted. So that means IT doesn't have to provision the encryption and go through all the pain associated with doing that. The device is encrypted out of the box. Our customers, probably you guys actually, said, we love this idea. Put that in all of Windows. And so with Windows 8.1, device encryption will be in every edition of Windows. And the default configuration for Windows will be to be implemented with device encryption. If you want to manage encryption, essentially store keys or do reporting, you can quickly apply BitLocker management capability on top of this with no transformation. In fact, if you're using Microsoft BitLocker administration and monitoring, the moment the client arrives on the PC, it instantly goes into a BitLocker configuration without any complexity at all. The second the client's there, you're really running BitLocker, even though it started as device encryption. But it's automatically provisioned. It's manageable if you're running professional and enterprise. So if you have the base edition of Windows, that still gives you great encryption technology, great for consumer and BYOD. But if you want to manage that, you really need professional or enterprise. One last thing that's important is, in order for device encryption to be implemented, it requires that the PC meet a certain standard, which is fairly new. It's called Connected Standby is the name, and we just changed it a week ago. It's now called Instant Go is the new marketing name. What that is a hardware architecture that you find on tablets. So if you're familiar with Surface RT and many of the new tablets, they're like your mobile phone. They're instantly turned on. They get great battery life. You can get 8+ hours of battery life out of these devices. And so they have a mobile phone-like power management capability. They also have some security elements in them as well. Every connected standby device has to have UEFI, so it has to have secure boot. It must have TPM. It must not have DMA ports. It must be basically not susceptible to cold boot attacks. And so Instant Go devices are very secure. And for this reason, we require Instant Go technology before we will implement device encryption. We don't believe that you can have a secure encryption scenario without TPM and UEFI and these things, because people can work around the encryption if you don't have that capability. So keep that in mind. Connected standby or Instant Go technology will trickle down from tablets into laptops, into desktops, and all-in-ones beginning later this year. And next year, we expect towards the end of the year, that Instant Go will probably become the standard configuration for new PCs. So you're going to get great battery life on these laptops very, very soon. In fact, it's already starting to happen even now with Haswell just shipping. For those of you who want to know a little bit more about the difference between device encryption and BitLocker, there's really one difference. And that is BitLocker is manageable, and BitLocker allows you to add additional protectors to the encryption. Device encryption only protects the device with TPM. So that's the only protector. If you want pre-boot authentication, you would need to use BitLocker. So if you want to add a PIN or a password to the pre-boot experience, if you would like to be able to centrally report on it or centrally manage the keys, you need to go to BitLocker. But again, there's no transformation, there's no decrypt, re-encrypt. You just turn BitLocker on. It's as simple as clicking on a button effectively or using MBAM or some of the other features. One of the things that's interesting is there's a new thinking that I want you to have about BitLocker. A lot of you have thought in the past that you need to make a choice between BitLocker and McAfee or Symantec or Credent or Sophos or all these other companies doing encryption. What we're seeing in the marketplace is because we're starting to push our solution into the box with device encryption, and we started that even in 8, we're seeing third parties that we used to compete completely against, including the ability to manage BitLocker. Sophos manages BitLocker. Dell manages BitLocker. Wave Systems manages BitLocker. So if you look at BitLocker and you look at MBAM and you're like, you know, it doesn't have that pre-boot authentication feature that I want, even though it's pretty good, if you need something that's maybe to the next level, think about using BitLocker plus Sophos or BitLocker plus Dell. Because then you can get the beauty of BitLocker, which is the best performance, the best reliability, a lot of great things that BitLocker has, but maybe you can get the additional management features that you feel you need. So it's no longer a choice between BitLocker and a third party. It could be BitLocker plus third party. But hopefully Microsoft BitLocker plus MBAM are good enough for you. So think about that. Okay. Another feature, and I think this one's going to be fairly exciting to many of you, especially with BYOD. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide, but of course you know that your data is leaking outside of your organization. You have very little control of it, especially on unmanaged devices. If you allow corporate data to end up on an unmanaged device, you've probably lost complete control of that data under normal circumstances. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted with 8.1 to create the condition so that Windows could quickly detect the difference between users' data and corporate data, right? Today that's very, very hard to do. Today, if you're using a DLP solution, that DLP solution is using a series of rules and it's groveling your file system looking for files that look like they have information on it, right? So if Microsoft was using a solution like this, we would have a rule that says look for any file that contains the word Microsoft Confidential inside it. And so as you know, looking within every single file in the file system, when we have literally hundreds of thousands of files, a very expensive performance problem, or has huge performance implications. So what we want to do is create the condition where we can easily mark data. Okay, this is corporate, this is non-corporate, so we can quickly identify it, and then more importantly, selectively wipe it. So with Windows 8.1, we have a feature called Selective Wipe, which will encrypt the data that you send to a device, whether it's domain joined or non-domain joined. It will encrypt it and, in effect, mark it with your corporate identity. And then using EAS protocol or OMADM, which is a new management protocol for Windows 8.1, you can issue a wipe command that will destroy the encryption keys for the files and leave the data inaccessible. And then the application itself that uses that data has the option to physically delete the file. So by default, we destroy the keys. The application and the person who designs the application will decide if the file should be deleted. The reason why we don't delete the file automatically with Windows is if, let's imagine that you had a file replication service that replicated data in the cloud and was shared amongst many users. If Windows destroyed that data, that change would get replicated to the cloud and it would delete all your corporate data. So we don't make that choice for you. Your application will make that choice. But you will have data that is completely inaccessible. I know a lot of you worry about leaving encrypted data on PCs. Obviously, you would like it to be gone forever. But once you delete this encryption key, it's inaccessible forever. So this is very secure. And then you can work with your app vendors to make sure that if it makes sense to delete the data, that it's deleted from that app. So I want to be clear about what scenarios will work in 8.1 with this new capability. There are two applications that use this capability at launch, and there will be more apps that use this capability after launch. So mail, which ships in the box, will leverage this. Today, it uses the selective wipe feature, but it's not as sophisticated. It's not encrypted. You have the ability to use device wipe to delete the data. With 8.1, that data will be encrypted and then selectively wipeable in mail. Another thing that's nice in mail is when you have a mail container, and I have attachments. When those attachments leave the container, guess what? Typically, they're insecure. So we make sure that even in a situation where there's a container-like capability where data can be exported from the content, like attachments, the encryption travels with that data. So it can't leak outside of the container like we've had in Windows 8.1 in previous generations. So that's your attachments are now secure. So mail's one app. The second app is a feature called Work Folders, which is a new file replication capability. So it allows you to basically roam your content from multiple PCs. As the PC data comes from the cloud, it will be marked a selective wipe, and then they can wipe it using OMADM to get rid of that. We're working with third parties like Adobe. We're working with first parties like the Office to implement selective wipe in the future. We don't have any announcements about Office using this feature yet. But this is a conversation we're having with them. So we could anticipate in the future that Outlook would take advantage of the capability. But for 8.1 RTM, it's just mail and work folders. So let's talk about malware resistance, and then we'll be getting close to our Q&A session. So there's two big features. Provable PC Health is a code name. We will come up with a proper marketing name later in the year before we ship, but this is the name that came from our engineering team, so it doesn't have the pizzazz that I'll give it later in the year. but Provable PC Health is a feature that can detect the worst possible type of malware on your PC. The challenge that your anti-malware solution has today is it can only detect malware if the PC has not been affected with some of the most evil types of malware. So if you had a boot kit on your PC, Windows would never see it, and your anti-malware solution will never see it. If we had Flame version 2, that feature UEFI Secure Boot and Trusted Boot that I mentioned earlier, which are supposed to prevent boot in rootkits, Flame V2, that would never be detected by that system either, right? Because what happens there is you have a binary that has what looks like it's properly signed, so it would trick the UEFI system and it would trick Trusted Boot. So we need a way to remotely analyze a PC to be able to detect whether it has these types of infections, because these types of infections cannot be detected locally, period, right? There's no way that any local anti-malware solution can detect something as sophisticated as Flame. Maybe theoretically it's possible, but it won't happen, right? We know that those systems can be defeated. So Provable PC Health is a cloud service that will detect some of some of the most terrible types of malware. And so here's what's going to happen with Provable PC Health. There is a client This client is not Windows Defender. This is something that's part of Windows itself. So it's not part of any anti-malware solution we have, although it is an anti-malware capability. This is just a native part of Windows itself. This client will, on a periodic basis, harvest a series of data. The first set of data is called measured boot data. Measured boot is a Windows 8 feature that takes basically hashes of the UEFI firmware, all option ROM firmware, the OS loader, all OS boot components, and your anti-malware driver. So we basically take integrity measurements of these, and we do it using the TPM. So these are secured, accurate representations of the integrity of these components. And then on Windows 8, that's all we did with it. With provable PC health, we'll be collecting this data, and we can analyze it. But we'll look at some other stuff, too. Any kernel mode drivers, drivers that can run with high privilege, we will take hashes, integrity measurements of those. We will then query Action Center to check the status of all your security components. So is my anti-malware solution installed? Is it running? Is it up to date with the latest signatures? Is my firewall running? All these things that you know would represent, is my system secure? All of that gets collected and sent to the cloud. The cloud will then analyze this information. And in the case of the measured boot data, let's imagine that Flame V2 comes out. So we have an OS bootloader that looks like it's Microsoft's, that's malicious. It's signed by our signature, so it looks authentic. Our cloud service, because it has a database of every known good bootloader that we've ever shipped, would instantly see that as something that is foreign. So it, even though it looks like it's signed by us, and we think it's secure from that perspective, we will know that this is something we never shipped. And we will then know that that PC has been infected with a Flame of the future. And so we'll be able to detect this. This is something you can't do locally today. We will detect this, and then we will respond to the client with a message. That message will help the user determine how do they remediate this problem. Do they reinstall the OS? Do they use a push button reset? Do they go to Windows Defender offline and boot to a clean OS and scan the PC and clean it that way? We will help them understand how to solve this problem. Then, if the virus or the malware on the PC has the potential to compromise their Microsoft account identity, maybe it was a keylogger, and we know that they've probably been logging keys, we will let them know that that MSA account was very likely compromised, and we will also warn them that other accounts that they may have used on that PC may have been compromised as well, and then provide a recommendation on how they can address that as well. Today, when your account is when you have malware that can steal your identity, it's unlikely that you would be informed about that. That situation usually goes unbeknownst to the end user, and they have a hacked account. They just don't know it. So this is pretty cool. So this is a great story, right? This detects the undetectable today. But I want to be really transparent about the limitation of this. This feature is designed for consumers and for bring your own device. There's no management piece to this yet. That might be a roadmap feature where we'd have centralized reporting. If I'm an IT shop, when that machine remediation message gets sent to the PC, I want to receive that message as well. We don't have that capability today. But this detects something that your internal software probably can't detect. And so I think you're going to be better off using this service and allowing it to run than you are without it. So I know it doesn't have the enterprise management features that you really want. We're taking that as feedback because we know that this is important. But we encourage you to really seriously consider allowing this service to run because it's going to find things that you can't. Even though it's not the best from a communication to the client. It's good for consumers because it lets them know, but it's not good for IT for that reason. But we recommend you think about it anyway. As far as privacy goes, the data is not anonymous because I recollect the data and I have to communicate to the PC, right? So we have that ability. This information is not used in any other systems at Microsoft in any other way. It's simply designed so that we can identify this malware and let that device know. So you're not going to see this combined with other things that we have going on at Microsoft. The one thing that we would use it for, though, is we would use it to calculate how many times certain types of infections occurred, but we would not centrally store who was affected by that. We just want that number so we can report on it. So I want to be really transparent about this because this has implications that you would care about. All right, last feature area. So we've improved Defender and also Internet Explorer. So Windows Defender, if you're using SCEP, System Center Endpoint Protection, includes a feature that allows it to do network behavior monitoring. And so what's great about this is we can now detect known malicious types of behavior based on familiar patterns. And so we can detect new malware variants before signatures arrive, because we know, here's what really happens with malware. Most malware uses the same attack vector again and again and again, right? And then a new signature comes out and the author changes it just a little bit so it looks different and can't be detected and requires a new signature, and then it gets detected and then there's a new signature, and it just goes on and on and on and on. There's really not a lot of innovation in malware, I think, when you look at it all together, right? There's some in a very small subset, but most of them are just copycat type of things. Malware variants. So we've pushed this into Windows Defender, which of course is not an enterprise solution, but you are dealing with BYOD. And so now Windows Defender, which would be in a lot of your BYOD devices, will have much improved anti-malware capability than it had before. So that's pretty cool. Another feature is listed under Internet Explorer, but it's really a core feature that any browser can use. But Internet Explorer 11 will take advantage of it. But we think that Chrome and Firefox will adopt this feature as well. Today what happens is if you have a browser that has binary extensions, and let's use Internet Explorer as an example, a binary extension being ActiveX, what happens is when the user goes to a website, it will receive a payload, right, the code, and then the ActiveX control executes it immediately. And if it's a malicious payload of data that got sent to the control, what happens, hopefully, is the anti-malware solution detects the malicious activity and cleans it up. But that means you've been infected, and then you clean up. And so what we've done is we've changed the order of operations. Now what happens is the payload is received, it's sent to the anti-malware solution for inspection, and if it passes inspection, then it gets executed. So now we prevent the infection rather than clean it up. And so this is kind of it's not an aha moment, right? It's, why didn't you do this earlier? Well, we finally got to this feature, and so now it's there. But this is going to be great, because binary extensions are used pervasively in organizations, and so now we can prevent those infections before they happen using this capability. Assuming there's a signature for it, of course. Okay, so that covers all the new features in 8.1 that I think are notable. There's a few others. There's a couple things that we're doing to harden the system core. I don't have a slide on this, but I'll just give you a quick thing. One of the attack vectors that people like to do to attack the system is they like to inject code. And if you can inject code into a binary or a process that has high privilege, like a system process, you can do great damage. In Windows 8.1, we've protected our system processes, and it actually requires any sort of injection would require that the binary be signed by Microsoft. So our kernel area, if you want to call it that, our core system, has been hardened to a degree that we've never had before. There's also some things that we're doing to deal with pass the hash. Pass the hash is really a theoretical attack. It's probably been experienced by a few of you, but we still consider it fairly theoretical because it's not being used at scale. It probably will be used at scale in the future because it might actually be easier to do that than some of the other attack vectors. And there's a session here where they're going to talk about pass the hash. So if you're interested in that one, you might, I forget what the session number is, you might go attend that. I can't remember who's presenting it, but anyway, that's a session just dedicated to that one area. So with that, there you have it. There's Windows 8.1 security. I hope you're excited about these features we're delivering. The key things, I think the biometrics improvements, the PKI stuff we're doing, trustworthy identities, the things we're doing in the public space and also the private space, very important. Provable PC health, I know you want more. I can't wait to give you more in the future, but I think there's a lot there even today. At a minimum, it's going to help in BYOD. It's going to be great for BYOD. And then I think the fact that all devices are going to be encrypted and our selective wipe capability are all very, very compelling features. So with that, we have almost 15 minutes, 13 minutes for questions. I don't think there's a microphone up here, sadly, so it might be hard for me to hear you, so bear with me as I ask you to repeat yourself. So speak clearly and loudly. So anyway, any questions, anyone? Go ahead. How about biometrics and AD? Okay, so that would be, in our view, a bad thing to do, and it would have many benefits. It would be great, but it would also be bad from a privacy perspective. As we've talked to customers, they're concerned about their biometric identity being centrally stored, And while that would give us a lot of convenience, oh, there's a microphone. Great. Thank you. While it'd provide great convenience because I could roam my biometric identity, we think that the privacy concerns trump that convenience. There will be third parties who probably will provide that functionality to you. I talked to a customer just yesterday who's using a third-party product. I don't remember the name offhand. If you want to do that, that's something you can look into. But our view is that that's private data, should be used locally only. Is that consistent with your thinking? Maybe. It's a tough one, right? Because the convenience of roaming is fantastic, but the privacy concerns are too great. So we have to do that for now, and we'll allow third parties to maybe add that. Question number two, anyone? Hi.
Additionally to the authentication via biometrics, you always also have a password to authenticate, right?
Ah, yes, good question. So the question is, when I move to biometrics, am I killing passwords? So last year, in December, Matt Honan wrote an article, remember, Kill the Password, in Wired Magazine? So he said, we all need to move away from passwords as soon as possible. We agree. We want to get rid of passwords. The problem is that we can't get rid of them just yet. So our biometrics framework it basically encrypts your password and stores it, and then your biometric identity unwraps it, and then it passes through the password behind the scenes. So we're on a journey to get rid of passwords over time. Step one was virtual smart cards, which allows you to get away completely from passwords because you're using a certificate as your identity. Step two was to provide a new way of interacting with your identity, which is biometrics. Step three, I can't say what it is, but I think you could imagine what would be next if you did the mathematics. But just to be clear, to answer your question, it's not an alternative passwords yet.
But that means that it decreases security at the moment, because users receive a new password. They don't remind the password because they use authentication via biometrics, and they have to write down the password not to forget it.
Sure. So the question is related. Well, it might be less secure than what you have today with the password. It could be the way, depending on how you implement it. So I think we could sit down and have a lengthier conversation, but I think it would be possible for users to be provisioned a 48-digit password that is not something that they would need to know, that would be effectively almost like a one-time password for them to enroll in the device, but enroll their biometric identity, and then it automatically resets to a new password that they don't know. You could implement that. That would require some work on your end to implement that, but that would provide a much more secure thing. Once they use a biometric identity, they don't need to interact with their password anymore. It does get pushed away. So I think that to address your concern is you should be thinking about using passwords that are extremely long that users wouldn't use, and then force them into using biometrics as their way of authentication. But as I mentioned, this is a journey. There are multiple steps, and so we're doing a couple things at a time, and there will be a time where we're able, I think, to address all the convenience and some of the complexity that you're concerned about. So we need to do more work, but I think we've made a good step forward, at least at this point. Yeah. Another question there.
Hello. You were talking about BitLockers and implementation, and they've been few companies that actually claim that they've been able just to actually break the codes, and there's never been any kind of official answer from Microsoft about it. And
can
actually,
can I stop you? I heard just a BitLocker question. Can you repeat? Because it's muffled over here.
So I'm sorry. I mean, it's just there've been company you were talking about. Let's say where alternate companies using something else than BitLocker to encrypt the disk.
Sure.
So there've been several companies that claim, especially in my mind, that claim that they've been able to break the code. And there's never been any kind of official answer from Microsoft about it, and they actually sell the software as being something that can actually break BitLockers.
Okay. So do you work for Passware?
No, I'm not working for Passware. My question is, as a user, is basically basically assisting solutions. I mean, there's never been any kind of, let's say, any kind of answer or something that could say yes, the reason why, or justify the reason why. I mean, nothing, just nothing, which actually leaves some kind of blur area where people actually didn't know.
So you said break, or you mean like hack BitLocker?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a couple of companies out there that have mentioned that they have a way of hacking BitLocker. Those are those ones that I'm aware of, and I'm not sure specifically which one you're talking about. But Passware is the most famous. You know that one. Are the attack vectors similar to Passwares that you're talking about? Okay, so if we're talking about Passware, I can talk about that. So Passware is a company that has a tool that allows you to fish out the encryption key out of system memory. And so once a month, somebody says, a customer comes to me and saying, I'm not going to use BitLocker because of this issue. And then we have a conversation on the phone, and they go, okay, I feel much better. And the reason why they feel much better is if you configure BitLocker with worst practices, you're susceptible to the Passware attack. If you configure it with best practices, you're not susceptible. So the Passware attack is where a cold boot attack is used on the PC to harvest the keys out of memory using a DMA attack. There's another attack too. They use DMA, but you could use maybe a frozen memory, RIP memory remnants attack as well. So basically the scenario is you boot the PC. There's no pre-boot authentication. The encryption key gets booted into memory. You stick a device into FireWire. You dump system memory. You run Passware on the tool. You get the encryption key, decrypt the drive, access the data. So that's how that attack vector works. Best practice is to basically use pre-boot authentication. If you use pre-boot authentication, the encryption key doesn't get loaded into memory until an authenticated user boots. And then you should use hibernation as a means to unload the encryption keys when the device is unattended. So that's a good mitigation, and that's what we recommend all customers do to deal with this. So our view is Passware is not a problem unless you configure your PC incorrectly. But what we're doing is we want to get rid of pre-boot. Pre-boot is a pain. I have to prevent the PC from running, which means it's not accessible remotely while it's unattended. And it just kind of gets in the way. It means I need to add a password up front, and then I boot, and then maybe I need to sign in with my smart card, or maybe it's all integrated. There's lots of different ways of doing it. Our goal is to eliminate the situations or the condition where a device would need pre-boot authentication. Connected standby or instant go devices don't need preboot. And why is that? It's because they don't have DMA ports. The memory on those devices today is soldered onto the motherboard if it's a tablet. And so the frozen memory trick doesn't work. The DMA ports don't exist, so that Passware could never work on that. And so that allows you to leave your device on all the time. It's always running, it's always connected, and it's not susceptible to these attacks. So we believe that Instant Go technology should trickle down, and we're working on trickling it down to other devices. And our goal is in the future that you wouldn't need pre-boot authentication to protect a PC. So that's kind of our strategy. But it will take time, right? I mean, today you have devices with FireWire probably still. If 3 years from now, maybe not. In 5 years from now, unless you're using really old PCs, this all assumes you're on a five-year PC recycle mode, these DMA attacks will probably not be a problem. Does that help?
I mean, the main point of, let's say, of my question was much more, I mean, what I was surprised that there was just no official answer from Microsoft about such, which actually leave the people, I mean, in the cloud somehow.
Yeah.
It's much more than that point.
Okay. Well, I think that our message probably just hasn't been delivered in a way where it resonated broadly enough. There is a blog on this. It was written, it might have been 5 years ago. So maybe it's kind of become buried. But there is a blog on it. It talks about Passware, I think, specifically. But if you did like BitLocker, DMA attacks, you'll eventually find a blog on that. I think that we should improve our documentation so that this is more prevalent, you know, in the face of our customers, because this is one of the most popular questions I get, actually.
Frankly speaking, with you, I had an argument with my security officer. I lost because I just could not prove.
Yep.
So it's again noise. I mean, from let's say 100 sites, again, maybe one area saying, okay, if you apply this, it's probably not going to be an issue.
Yeah.
Not probably be an issue.
Yeah.
That's not enough.
Yeah. Well, I one piece of good news. Before I left for Europe here, there was a small team it's going to address this issue indirectly. We're going to write a small paper about pre-boot authentication, when to use it and when not to use it, because we have these new devices coming out. And so I don't have a date on it yet, but I'm thinking maybe in August or September a paper will be written. And so I think that will help us quite a bit. So that's a great question. Any other questions? Oh, we're out of time. Okay, I'm sorry. So we have like a minute and a half, I think. So I'll use that minute if you don't mind. So maybe one more quick question, and then I have time outside of here. I'll wait for a few minutes and field more if there are any. Go ahead. Last question there.
Hang on.
Yeah.
With the secure wipe technology, do you prevent valid use decryption cases like printing, for instance?
So do we prevent
valid decryption scenarios like printing? So you have the encrypted file that appears in your email, for instance, which is able to be remotely wiped, yeah? So if the user prints that to, say, a PDF printer, is that disabled?
All right. So selective wipe is not a DLP, a data leak prevention. The way I'm positioning it is it gives organizations more control over their data. So if somebody receives your data and they're an employee, and then tomorrow morning they are no longer an employee, that you would be able to initiate a wipe command and get more control over the data, more likely that it would not leak with the user. The user would be able to print it, would be able to leak it off the device using a USB. So it's not leak prevention, it's really just about control. What we anticipate is third parties will use this capability. So I'd expect like CA and Symantec, anybody doing DLP, rather than file system groveling, that they may use this data, because we now have all this metadata on files, that they can use that to more quickly find data and then add the harness that you're looking for. No print, no leak, all that stuff. So good question. So that's it. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time. I hope you enjoyed the information. And I'll take some more questions outside.